Hi, everyone. We are thrilled to have Glass Health as our sponsor. Let's hear from Dr. Derek Paul, the co-founder and CEO of Glass Health, which is a platform that empowers clinicians with the best-in-class AI, or as you'll hear, large language models for clinical decision support.
The most loved feature on our platform is our differential diagnosis feature. And what we hear from folks is that it's most useful to them in complex cases where they get stuck. So maybe it's a patient that has kind of not been doing well for multiple days in the ICU, and you're not sure if you have treatment failure or maybe we missed something here. So in those sort of situations, it's been very useful for folks to put in information about their case and actually do an LLM-generated differential diagnosis. And we're seeing that too in primary care and in complex presentations to the ED or urgent care, where the LLM isn't making the diagnosis, but it's helping you expand your differential and sort of suggesting things to think about that maybe you haven't thought about because you've never seen it before.
There is a free version as well as Glass Pro version where you get unlimited AI queries. Good news is that you can get 1 month free access to Glass Pro using the promo code CoreIM. We'll link it in our show notes. And with that, let's get into the episode.
I cannot tell you the number of times that I have activated a code stroke because of anisocoria or weakness or a facial droop that is not new. For example, I had a case relatively recently where this patient, a nurse had found them to be altered and they had a left-sided facial droop. And so I activated a code stroke. It ultimately turned out that they had had an old stroke. And in the morning, the provider had said, that's old. Their daughter told me that they've had a facial droop for a long time, but it hadn't made it into the chart. And so I wasn't able to determine that this was old and the patient didn't know.
That's Dr. Maria Rosasco, a nocturnist. And you may remember her voice from the memorable July Stories episode last year. She is the queen of storytelling, and she had so many stories that we drew upon to learn all things on how do we give better signouts and particularly do contingency planning. Welcome to CoreIM. I'm Dr. Shreya Trivedi, and I'm joined by...
I'm Dr. Taylor Cox, an attending at Mount Sinai Hospital. Shreya, I reached out to you about handoffs and contingency planning because during my chief year, I was constantly hearing feedback about handoffs, and I was struggling with how to coach others. It's so easy to give too much information and not enough information all at the same time.
It is so hard. And so when you reached out to do this episode, I was like, heck yes, I'm always up for a good educational challenge. And yeah, as you mentioned, you know, as we did put together this episode, I think we did realize the challenge that we were up against, right? Ideally, we would have come up with this like clean, neat formula or framework on contingency planning. But every patient is so different and every handoff is so unique.
Yeah, and on top of that, we were looking, but we couldn't find any practical studies except for information on IPAS to help guide us. So we decided to interview the people on the receiving end of those signouts, the nocturnists.
Yeah, and I'm actually really glad we took this approach because I'm such a big believer in stories and the empathy that these stories can create when you hear a not-so-ideal contingency plan. It can just be so powerful and practice-changing to kind of hear and get that feedback.
And of course, this is by no means comprehensive, but from conversations with a few people on the receiving end of those signouts, some we didn't include on air in the episode, there were five themes and questions to ask yourself that really stood out.
Yeah. So we think these five questions will be a good foundation to continue to build upon. And even if you're seasoned at signouts, we can all use a reminder in different contexts and different ways, especially with some of these very real and humbling stories. The first question to ask yourself, and maybe arguably the most important one when it comes to contingency planning, is thinking through what makes this person different from all the other patients with similar symptoms or diagnoses.
In my mind, the main value that the DAFOs can provide is to help me do bespoke medicine. What I really need that only the day person can provide is this really specific, critical context and synthesis that lets me provide really specific care to patients. But if it's too general, I think of that as sort of like the chatbot version of the contingency. You know, if a problem, do the standard thing. And I think it's much more helpful if you're going to give me some direction to deviate from sort of the standard care.
I know that I've written my fair share of if chest pain, get EKG, if febrile, then culture, but Maria brings up a good point. These contingencies are already the immediate reactions our colleagues are going to have overnight.
Yeah, so the takeaway is to really think through what makes the management of this person's symptoms different from typical management. And we actually sat down with Dr. Aaron Troy, a cardiology fellow at Hopkins, and he had a good framework for how he approaches his contingencies. Now, this doesn't cover everything, but I think it's a good start. And the first question being, of course, what makes this patient unique with regard to this symptom?
Second, what's the empiric evaluation if the symptom occurs?
Third, what's empiric treatment if the symptom occurs?
And fourth, at what point would you escalate care and how would you escalate care?
Yep. And then let's hear how he applies that approach to two different patients admitted for a very common symptom, chest pain.
You might write chest pain. Patient has unrevascularized left main disease and is on board for cath in the morning. If the chest pain is worsening, evaluate them at bedside, repeat the troponin and EKG, and start and maximize a nitro drip. If there's ectopy on telemetry, persistent chest pain on nitroglycerin, or any vital sign changes, I would page the fellow and ask about activating the cath lab overnight. For another patient's chest pain who you've fully evaluated and you're less worried about, you might write something like chest pain, patient with negative core angio this morning and known severe anxiety. If similar to the reported exam above, no need for in-person evaluation. If there's a change in quality, would repeat the EKG and troponin and assess at bedside. Could consider trying as needed hydroxyzine or Tums. If that's not working, try sublingual nitroglycerin. If the chest pain is newly anginal, there's a positive troponin or EKG. At that point, I would page the fellow.
I think the first line of both really does a good job identifying what makes them different than your average patient with chest pain, specifically knowledge of their coronary arteries. It then breaks down next steps for evaluation if the chest pain recurs, empiric treatment, and when you should be escalating the problem to a consultant overnight.
Yeah, then that's a solid recap of how to be specific for the symptom of chest pain. And because practice is so important, let's apply how we can be even more specific for an all-too-common scenario on the quote-unquote altered patient.
Yeah, when you hear altered, it can mean so many different things.
Yeah, this is where I get on my soapbox because I care a lot about this. I kind of actually cringe when I see notes that don't comment how specifically someone is altered, like, can they hold a conversation? Are they dozing off in the middle of their speech? Are they having hyperactive delirium? And what does that look like? Are they seeing things?
And we heard a ton of stories while we were preparing for this episode where workup was missed because the sign out wasn't specific on how exactly the patient was altered. And so the covering person couldn't recognize that something was different.
Yeah. And then on top of that, it can be helpful when you leave recommendations for treatment options, right? What type of redirection usually works? Is there a family member who wants to be called at all times to help with redirection? If we're at the point of medications, what are the exact meds to try?
So if they have previously received antipsychotics for their behavioral disturbance, what's worked, what's caused unintended side effects or undesirable side effects, what doses have worked. Often this is an urgency or an emergency, and I might not have the luxury of time to sort of mine the chart for all of this information.
So I think in terms of takeaways, the first concept is really about tailoring your handoffs, which I think is very difficult to teach and learn. You have to actively ask yourself, what should I communicate that is specific and different about this patient? So the first question was to ask yourself, what about this patient makes them unique? Maria also had a great story that brings up the second question to ask yourself, which is, does the covering team that we're handing off to have all the tools they need to follow up on what I'm asking for them? In other words, did we set up the night team for success? And there were, again, lots of examples of this one too, and we narrowed down to high-yield examples. Let's hear the first one.
A patient was admitted with a lower gastrointestinal bleed, and I was asked to follow up a CBC and transfuse as needed. And their hemoglobin had been in the 10 to 11 range. And the person signing out to me said, you know, I really don't think it will meet the transfusion threshold, but I'm just checking one more tonight for my own peace of mind. And the of course, the hemoglobin was 6 and this person was having a significant amount of bleeding overnight. But the problem was that because the person during the day had been sure that they would not reach a transfusion threshold, they did not have a blood consent. The patient had dementia. They could not consent for themselves. They also did not speak English as a first language. Their healthcare proxy also did not speak English as a first language, and in fact spoke a rare dialect of a particular language for which we do not have an interpreter on staff. And so I was in a position where, you know, I was asked to follow up on this lab, but it was non-actionable, this contingency. I didn't have the tools that I needed to do what needed to be done.
This story really hits home for me because I've both been in the situation where I'm trying to cobble together a type and screen, get IV access, get consent overnight. And I've also forgotten to tee all of this up for my overnight team.
We think we've all been there. And I think we do need to give ourselves some grace when this does happen, right? We're juggling so much and try to move forward from it and learn to do better next time. So moving on to second example of, you know, does the covering team have all the information they need? It's actually around complications post-procedure.
And for that, we sat down with Dr. Margot Hedlund, a nocturnist whose voice you may remember from our At the Bedside segment.
There are plenty of times that we're monitoring someone after they've had a procedure. It's really helpful to know what the expected complications are and how do you manage them. So, for example, at this hospital, we do a lot of hepatic artery embolizations to cut off the blood supply to certain like tumors in the liver. It is very common for people to have pretty severe abdominal pain and for people to have fevers after that procedure is done. Those are not complications that the interventional radiology team usually wants to know about. Those aren't complications that you usually need to start antibiotics or get a scan for. But that's not something I would have known the first couple of times that I covered a patient who had just gotten that particular procedure.
Yes. And this was honestly one of the most practice-changing parts for me from working on this episode. I recently was on service and interventional radiology had called for a sign out on a patient that they just placed a percutaneous nephrostomy tube in. And they were like, yeah, expect some bloody output. We did some biopsies of what we think is urothelial cancer. It's a highly viable cancer. And usually I'd be like, okay, thanks so much. But then I remembered Margot's story and I was like, wait a minute. Just in case a night nurse gets worried and calls coverage, at what point should someone reach out or get further workup for the bloody output? And the IR attending, she gave very clear recommendations. And yes, sure enough, you know, night coverage got paged for that bloody output. And thankfully, IR didn't get woken up in the middle of the night. And more importantly, the patient didn't get any extra unnecessary imaging.
And that's something that, like, as a day person, you have access to the consulting teams in the way that the night person does not. Sometimes something like is a little bit worrying to me, but I'm not sure if it's worth waking somebody up at 3 a.m. But like when it's 4 p.m. and you've got the GI fellow's cell phone number, I think people will appreciate being asked for clarification if you sort of say that the goal of this is to make sure we know what to call for overnight and what we can manage on our own.
And much like altered mental status, another all too common pain point is pain management.
Pain. Nice pun there.
I think it can take a lot of time to search through the chart and gather all the information that you need to manage pain overnight if there's not already a clear plan in place.
Yeah. And so how can we be more specific when it comes to our pain contingencies for the patients that we know a lot better during the daytime than the covering person?
And I think that at night, I want to be faithful to the pain plan and the boundaries that you have worked really hard to establish during the day and to try to help you and the patient work towards the goals that you set together. But sometimes that's hard to do without a little extra information. I receive a lot of signouts that say something like, avoid IV opioids overnight. And okay, yes. But I, you know, I need more information because if the patient is saying they have pain and IV opioids are off the table, then help me understand what's on the table. Can they get an extra dose of something else? What's worked before? Can they get an oral opioid? Can they get some type of adjunctive agent? What can I offer them?
Yeah. And you know, it can be so hard to receive pages from nurses that the patient's requesting more things for pain. And actually, Taylor, to be honest, like this was actually a thing that was a bit morally distressing for me when I was a night intern, when I'd get these pages and I have nothing to offer these patients because, yeah, I want to adhere to the boundaries the day team set or the prior clinician had set and do a good job for them.
I received a pretty good contingency on this the other night, which was a patient who had a history of opioid use disorder and alcohol use disorder and was admitted with alcohol-induced pancreatitis. And the contingency said that the goal was to work toward discharging home in the next 1 to 2 days. And that to that end, they asked to avoid additional doses of IV opioids overnight. If there were pain, okay for additional doses of oral opioids. And they gave some specific doses. And that's a really helpful contingency because it helps me align with your goals and what the patient is working toward. But in this case, so I got the page, I gave an additional dose of oral opioid. And then I got another page about an hour later that said, hey, this patient's having a lot of pain still. Can we give them something IV? And so I said, let me come to the bedside. And I went to see this patient and she said, something feels totally different. Like I'm in excruciating pain. Something feels wrong. And the patient was peritoneal and it turned out that they had had a perperforation. I think that, you know, to me, this contingency was excellent, but it was also a good reminder that, you know, I'm not beholden to it.
And the patient's whole hospital course just changed. And it's great that Maria went to the bedside and readdressed, even though she had a very good and specific contingency. And while this episode is written mostly with the goal of improving signouts to your covering colleagues, I do want to pause briefly and highlight how important it is to trust your own intuition and clinical judgment if you're the covering person and something just seems off to you.
Right. And that was such a good story, yeah, both on the giving and the receiving end of that sign out. So this one may not need much of a summary because I think the stories are so powerful in and of itself, whether it be, you know, following up on a hemoglobin for a GI bleed or signing out a patient post-procedure. I think we can think about how can we set up our colleagues for success by asking ourselves, you know, do they have everything they need to follow up on things or the information they need should things arise?
And I'm sure there's so many more examples. We would love to hear what examples you have and put together a collection of more specific context to think through so we can make sure our night teams have all the information they need. Okay, so the third question is quite simple, but you'd be surprised how often this comes up. It's the question of asking, did I update my handoff today?
I was working nights and I was caring for a critically ill patient and I received a page that a different patient was hypoxic. They had been on room air and now they were on 2 liters nasal cannula. The nurse said they didn't have any respiratory symptoms. And so I pull up the chart and I look at the contingencies and there is one and it says, this patient has COVID. They are on room air. If they become hypoxic, then start dexamethasone. And I think on its face, this contingency is okay. They are telling me, you know, what they have forecast to possibly happen, what is the likely diagnosis, and giving me some guidance for therapeutics. And so I ordered the dexamethasone, and only later did I realize that this contingency was stale, that this was over 3 weeks old, that this diagnosis of COVID was a long time ago and probably no longer relevant to their hypoxia.
Oh man, I can feel for both sides here. On one hand, there's just so much stuff to do during the day that you might not get to updating it. But man, 3 weeks of not updating a contingency is a bit extreme.
But actually, Shreya, while this is a no-brainer, you know, for me, this is one of the biggest problems I see.
Really?
Yeah, especially with our less active patients. Their handoff still has information about their urosepsis from 3 weeks ago. Especially those patients waiting for rehab for weeks. And of course, one night they inevitably get septic. Then the handoff has really old information that may no longer apply to them anymore.
And of course, if the covering team, you know, doesn't do their due diligence, you know, the patient can get some real harm or unnecessary testing or treatment done if they don't see that this is an outdated sign out. So this one's a really quick question to ask yourself, which is, you know, was my sign out updated? And maybe sometimes the most important update you can make is removing the things that shouldn't be there anymore. You know, we've been talking all about contingencies, and Margo brought up a really good point that sometimes, particularly patients who are critically ill, need more than just contingency planning about their medical problems. So the fourth question is asking yourself what prognostic information and goals of care information would be important to pass along.
Because it's very common that I hear like, oh, like the patient's healthcare proxy is on board, but the patient's daughter is not. Even knowing, you know, like obviously we can't, not all day teams are going to be able to like wrap up a difficult situation with like a pretty bow, but at least knowing that there is sort of conflict within the family or that the patient is capacitated, but kind of like on the verge of becoming too sick to make their own medical decisions. Just knowing that I'm walking into a situation where there might be a little bit of difficulty when it comes to those conversations is helpful to know.
Margo brings up something that I've definitely felt before, which is a bit of shame if everything's not wrapped up nicely by the time of sign out.
Which can be hard to do. And I think though what's worse is that when we're not explicit about the things that are up in the air, or more commonly what I've seen is people just omit things altogether about where things stand with goals of care. And then like you really have to do chart digging and figuring out yourself. You're like, wait, I feel so blindsided that this was not told to me.
I care a lot more about people having the conversations than about the conclusion of the conversation. Ultimately, people are not coming to the hospital devoid of all the conflict that existed in their life beforehand. They're not coming to the hospital having accepted their mortality. At least having had that conversation is critically important because people need time to process this.
And sometimes it's hard also because you feel like you didn't make much progress in the day, you know, but giving patients and families time to process can be what they need. And if things arise for the covering team, it might be an easier conversation for them because you planted that seed.
Right. And then with these sick patients, Margo also helped us realize that any prognostic information can be helpful. And it's not really something I've put a lot of thought into before, at least in the setting of handoffs.
I think most people will just communicate, oh, this patient's DNR, DNI, or full code. But prognostic information can be really impactful to share for the next team.
I have been informed that some folks with pulmonary arterial hypertension, some folks with interstitial lung disease, their chance of surviving intubation and coming off the ventilator is just slim to none. And so that's really, really important information to have because I don't want to offer patients a false choice. If someone with respiratory failure who cannot be liberated from the vent is now maxed out on high flow with a non-rebreather over top, like hopefully this conversation has happened earlier, but I don't want to say like, let's intubate you without giving them the chance to say goodbye, without giving them the honest information that would shape their preferences when they're coming to the end of their life.
Just to put it out there, prognosis is such a difficult skill, definitely out of the scope of this episode. And shameless plug for a whole Quorum episode on prognosis that the At the Bedside team did.
Just because someone has metastatic breast cancer doesn't mean that they're dying in a couple of months. There are people who can live with certain kinds of cancers for just shockingly long periods of time. And so they might have like, their oncologist might have four treatment options down the line.
You know, I love these points because maybe an oncologist or a pulmonologist or whoever, you know, may make some like offhand comment about the prognosis of a patient. And for me, what I'm going to try to do is incorporate that into my sign out. And of course, you know, also being open and honest about where things may stand in goals of care conversations, even if things are not wrapped up in a pretty bow.
And that last point of everything being wrapped up in a neat bow lends itself nicely to our last question to ask yourself, which is, what things am I uncertain about that would be good for the night team to not take as a hard and fast rule on my sign out and be open to rethinking?
This was a person with metastatic lung cancer who was on a clinical trial for a type of immunotherapy. And she'd gotten this clinical trial drug a couple weeks prior and was coming in with just profound hypoxic respiratory failure. I was told it was progression of disease. When I asked about the differential, they said there's not really a differential. We're treating her for everything anyway. And I asked what to do if she gets worse, and they said turn up the oxygen. So going into the night, I kind of unsurprisingly get a call around 11 p.m. that she's desatting on 50 liters, 50% oxygen. And I just, sort of long story short, spend a tremendous amount of time with her. And so I came to the conclusion this was probably due to the clinical trial drug. And in the middle of the night, I called the PI for the study. And essentially, this really, really shaped the whole discussion because the principal investigator for the study pointed out that this was probably a side effect of the clinical trial. And we stayed in very, very close contact over the course of the night as we tried different, like very, very strong immunosuppressant agents.
And I don't want anyone coming away from this episode feeling like they have to have the answer. You know, that's just not how medicine works. And of course, there's diagnostic uncertainty. And patients do sometimes reveal themselves at 1 to 2 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah. And acknowledging that diagnostic uncertainty can really help the covering team or next person triage.
Yeah. I remember when I first became an attending, receiving sign out for a service that I was taking over, and the prior attending had actually written, like, I'm actually not sure what's going on with her tachycardia, but this is what it could be. And I still remember reading that, like, openness and uncertainty and feeling like, wow, I had never seen anything written like that in residency. And you can just say things like that in a sign out?
Nothing in medicine is 100%. We're always working with margins of error. There are always going to be questions about what's going on, where we're going, how the patient's going to do. But I think it's really important to be honest about what we do and what we don't know.
And we have a very difficult job, which pulls us in a lot of directions. People are complex, and we just aren't capable of predicting everything that's going to happen, as much as we might like to.
Contingency planning, this is sort of like a partnership, you know, between day and night. And I think like any other partnership, it not only relies on communication, but trust and generosity. And you know, trying to remember that not everything can be forecast or planned for, and that we're all sort of trying our best. You know, I think when I was an intern, I worried a lot about contingency planning and signing out. And I felt like it was sort of like bad mark if like my sign out sheet had a lot of things on it. And I felt a lot of shame with that. Like I had somehow failed my patients or failed my colleagues to prepare them. And I think, I think like the most you can do is, you know, if something happened the last night, to try to do what you can to get out ahead of it, to, you know, keep it from happening the next night. You know, if your patient had a rapid response last night for AFib with RVR because they've been NPO and they haven't received their rate control medicines, and your colleagues had to work on that overnight, thinking about what can I do today to make sure that the same problems don't happen again overnight, and to sort of think about where the vulnerabilities of your patients are and response strategies to them. But that it's not a failure if your patients had activity overnight, that you can't forecast every problem. And that's what we're here for. I mean, that's why we have people caring for patients in-house 24/7.
And what a beautiful way to close out the episode, giving each other the benefit of the doubt and to not feel shame if despite our best efforts, there were blind spots and things we just couldn't predict.
So as a recap, the five questions we came up with when you're writing signouts and contingency planning are: ask yourself first, what specific information should I communicate about this person? Second, does the next team have all the tools to follow up on what I'm asking and the information to set them up for success? Third, is my handoff up to date? Fourth, what goals of care and prognostic information do I need to communicate? And fifth, what things am I still uncertain about that I should let the covering team know to help continue to keep a broad differential management plan?
Yes. And I'm sure there's tons more. Please write in. We'd love to hear your stories and tips. And we're going to end with one last story, which is really a treat from Maria about a very funny sign out that she got. But before then, we just want to thank you so much for joining us. You know, please do share this episode with your team, your colleagues. I think this is a really hard thing to do and we can all get better at it. And without further ado, here is the wonderful Dr. Maria Rosasco on, shall I say, a very unique sign out she received one day.
This is an elderly patient who had had a prolonged hospital stay, was being treated for tuberculosis, and had during the daytime developed hallucinations. Otherwise, and at times three, a normal neurologic exam, but they had developed hallucinations and they were specifically taking the form of ghosts. They were experiencing visions of ghosts in the bathroom of their room. The person that cared for this patient gave me a great sign out because I don't really have an algorithm for ghost busting at night. And, you know, I think here's where some specific knowledge about the patient really, really paid off. This was the knowledge that only the daytime doctor could provide to me, which is that, you know, he told me what he did during the day to sort of get rid of the ghosts, which included, you know, going into the patient's bathroom and asking the ghosts to leave and then moving the patient's room. And so, you know, I think, and he said, you know, these things worked. The patient's no longer seeing ghosts. So if the ghosts come back overnight, here are the things that you could try. And I had to activate the ghost contingency at night because, again, he had ghosts. You know, instead of just medicating the patient, I think the daytime doctor had really set me up for success by forecasting that this might recur, had given me a lot of really patient-specific context, really rich context to go to the bedside with and to treat the patient successfully.
Were you blasting the Ghostbusters theme music as you were, like, walking down the hospital?
It was really satisfying.
Okay, that last point about everything being wrapped up in a neat bowl. Wow, boy. Start over. Hopefully it's not wrapped up in a bowl. Boy. And that last point of everything being wrapped up in a neat bow. Bow. I can't say a bow today. Start over. And the last point of everything being wrapped up in a neat bow. And that last point of everything being wrapped up in a neat boy. I can't say the word boy. Bow. It's really sad. And that last, maybe Taylor, you should take this line. See, we're struggling.
And that last point of everything being wrapped up in a night.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.